possess.
Ah, believe me, dear Miss Prism, it is only the superficial qualities that last. Man's deeper nature is soon found out.
Child, I do not know where you get such ideas. They are certainly not to be found in any of the improving books that I have procured for you.
Are there ever any ideas in improving books? I fear not. I get my ideas in the garden.
Then you should certainly not be so much in the open air. The fact is, you have fallen lately, Cicely, into a bad habit of thinking for yourself. You should give it up. It is not quite womanly. Men don't like it. Mr. Worthing, I thought, I may say I was in hopes that you had already returned to town.
My departure will not long be delayed. I have come to bid you goodbye, Miss Cardew.
Oh, Mr. Worthing.
I'm informed that a dog cart has been already ordered for me. I have no option but to go back again into the cold world.
I hardly know, Mr. Worthing, what you can mean by using such an expression. The day, even for the month of July, is unusually warm.
Profligacy is apt to dull the senses.
No doubt. I'm far from defending the weather. I think, however, that it is only my duty to mention to you, Miss Prism, that Dr. Chasuble is expecting you in the vestry.
In the vestry? That sounds serious. It can hardly be for any trivial purpose that the rector selects for an interview a place of such peculiarly solemn associations. I do not think that it would be right to keep him waiting, Cicely.
It would be very, very wrong. The vestry is, I am told, excessively damp.
True. I had not thought of that. And Dr. Chasuble is sadly rheumatic. Mr. Worthing, we shall probably not meet again. You will allow me, I trust, to express a sincere hope that you will now turn over a new leaf in life.
I have already begun an entire volume, Miss Prism.
I am delighted to hear it. And do not forget that there is always hope even for the most depraved. Do not be idle, Cicely.
I have no intention of being idle. I realize only too strongly that I have a great deal of serious work before me.
Ah, that is quite as it should be, my dear.
This parting, Miss Cardew, is very painful.
It is always painful to part from people whom one has known for a very brief space of time. The absence of old friends one can endure with equanimity, but even a momentary separation from anyone to whom one has just been introduced is almost unbearable.
Thank you.
The dog cart is at the door, sir.
Miss Cardew?
It can wait, Merriman. For 5 minutes.
Yes, miss.
Miss Cardew, I hope I shall not offend you if I state quite frankly and openly that you seem to me, in every way, the visible personification of absolute perfection.
I think your frankness does you great credit, Mr. Worthing. If you will allow me, I will copy your remarks into my diary.
Oh, do you really keep a diary? I'd give anything to look at it, may I?
Oh, no. You see, it is simply a very young girl's record of her own thoughts and impressions, and consequently meant for publication. When it appears in volume form, I hope you will order a copy. But pray, Mr. Worthing, don't stop. I delight in taking down dictation. I have reached absolute perfection. You can go on. I'm quite ready for more. Oh, don't cough, Mr. Worthing. When one is dictating, one should speak fluently and not cough. Besides, I don't know how to spell a cough.
Miss Cardew, ever since 12:30 this afternoon, when I first looked upon your wonderful and incomparable beauty, I have not merely been your abject slave and servant, but soaring upon the pinions of a possibly monstrous ambition, I have dared to love you wildly, passionately, devotedly, hopelessly.
Oh, please say that all over again. You speak far too fast and far too indistinctly. Oh, kindly say it all over again.
Miss Cardew, ever since you were 12:30... ever since it was 12:30 this afternoon, when I first looked upon your wonderful and incomparable beauty...
Yes, I've got all that, all right.
I've not merely been your abject slave and servant, but soaring upon the pinions of a possibly monstrous ambition, I have dared to love you wildly, passionately, devotedly, hopelessly.
I have not taken down hopelessly. It doesn't seem to make much sense, does it?
Cicely!
Is that the beginning of an entirely new paragraph, or should it be followed by a note of admiration?
It is the beginning of an entirely new existence for me, and it shall be followed by such notes of admiration that my whole life shall be a subtle and sustained symphony of love, praise, and adoration combined.
Oh, I don't think that makes any sense at all. The fact is that men should never try to dictate to women. They never know how to do it, and when they do it, they always say something particularly foolish.
I don't care whether what I say is foolish or not. All that I know is that I love you, Cicely. I love you. I want you. I can't live without you, Cicely. You know I love you. Will you marry me? Will you be my wife?
Oh, you've made me make a blot. And yours is the only real proposal I've ever had in all my life. I should like to have ended it neatly.
The dog cart is waiting, sir.
Eh? Well, tell it to come round next week at the same hour.
Yes, sir.
Uncle Jack would be very much annoyed if he knew you were staying on till next week at the same hour.
Oh, I don't care about Jack. I don't care for anybody in the whole world but you. I love you, Cicely. You will marry me, won't you?
You silly boy, of course. Why have we been engaged for the last 5 months?
For the last 5 months?
5 months, all but a few days. Yes, it will be exactly 5 months on Thursday.
I didn't know.
Well, very few people nowadays ever realise the position in which they are placed. The age is, as Miss Prism often says, a thoughtless one.
But how did we become engaged?
Well, ever since dear Uncle Jack first confessed to us that he had a younger brother who was very wicked and bad, you, of course, have formed the chief topic of conversation between myself and Miss Prism. And, of course, a man who is much talked about is always very attractive. One feels there must be something in him after all. I dare say it was foolish of me, but I fell in love with you, Ernest.
Darling. But when was the engagement actually settled?
On the 14th of February last. Worn out by your entire ignorance of my existence, I determined to end the matter one way or the other. And after a long struggle with myself, I accepted you one evening in the garden. The next day I bought this little ring in your name. You see, I always wear it, Ernest.
Oh.
And though it shows that you are sadly extravagant, still I have long forgiven you for that. Here, in this drawer, are all the little presents you have given me from time to time, neatly numbered and labelled. And this is the pearl necklace that you gave me on my birthday.
Oh.
And this is the box in which I keep all your letters.
My letters? My own sweet Cicely, I've never written you any letters.
You need hardly remind me of that, Ernest. I remember it only too well. So I wrote your letters for you. I wrote always 3 times a week, sometimes oftener.
Oh, do let me read them, Cicely.
Oh, I couldn't possibly. They would make you far too conceited. The 3 you wrote me after I had broken off the engagement are so beautiful and so badly spelt that even now I can hardly read them without crying a little.
But was our engagement ever broken off?
Of course it was.
Oh.
On the 22nd of last March. You can see the entry if you like. Today I broke off my engagement with Ernest. I feel it is better to do so. The weather still continues charming.
Well, why on earth did you break it off? What had I done? I hadn't done anything at all, Cicely. I'm very much hurt indeed to hear you broke it off, particularly when the weather was so charming.
Men seem to forget very easily. I should have thought you would have remembered the violent letter you wrote to me because I danced with Lord Kelso at the county ball.
But I did take it all back, Cicely, didn't I?
Of course you did.
Yeah.
Otherwise I wouldn't have forgiven you, or accepted this little gold bangle with the turquoise and diamond heart that you sent me the next day.
Did I give you this, Cicely? It's very pretty, isn't it?
Yes, you have wonderfully good taste, Ernest. I've always said that of you. It's the excuse I've always given for your leading such a bad life.
My own one. So we've been engaged for 5 months, Cicely.
Yes. How the time has flown, hasn't it?
Oh, I don't think so. I've found the days very long and very dreary without you.
Oh, you dear romantic boy. I hope your hair curls naturally. Does it?
Yes, darling. With a little help from others.
I'm so glad.
You'll never break off our engagement again, Cicely.
I don't think I could break it off now that I've actually met you. Besides, of course, there is the question of your name.
How do you mean?
Well, you must not laugh at me, darling, but it had always been a girlish dream of mine to love someone whose name was Ernest. There is something in that name that seems to inspire absolute confidence. I pity any married woman whose husband is not called Ernest.
But my dear child, do you mean to say you could not love me if I had some other name?
But you have no other name.
Well, that is quite true, but supposing my godfathers and godmother had given me some other name.
But what name?
Oh, any name you like. Algernon, for instance.
Oh, but I don't like the name Algernon.
Well, my own sweet darling, I really can't see why you should object to the name of Algernon. It's not at all a bad name. In fact, it is rather an aristocratic name.
I fear it must be. I've often come across it in the newspapers in connection with rather painful court cases.
But seriously, Cicely, if my name was Algernon, couldn't you love me?
I might respect you, Ernest. I might admire your character, but I fear that I would not be able to give you my undivided attention.
How perfectly terrible.
Why, Ernest?
Oh, nothing, darling. Cicely, your rector here is, I suppose, thoroughly experienced in the practice of all the rites and ceremonials of the church?
Oh, yes. Dr. Chasuble is a most learned man. He has never written a single book, so you can imagine how much he knows.
I must see him at once on a most important christening. I mean, on most important business.
Oh.
I shan't be away more than half an hour, darling.
Oh, considering that we have been engaged since February the 14th and that I only met you today for the first time, I think it is rather hard that you should leave me for so long a period as half an hour. Couldn't you make it 20 minutes?
I'll be back in no time.
Oh, what an impetuous boy he is. I like his hair so much. I must enter his proposal in my diary.
Miss Fairfax has just called to see Mr. Worthing on very important business.
Is Mr. Worthing not in his library?
Mr. Worthing went over in the direction of the rectory some time ago.
Oh, pray show the lady in. Mr. Worthing is sure to be back soon. And you can bring tea.
Very well, miss.
Miss Fairfax? I suppose one of the many good women who are associated with Uncle Jack in some of his philanthropic work in London. I don't quite like women who are interested in philanthropic work. I think it is so forward of them. Perhaps she is not a good woman at all. Perhaps she is only a new woman. I don't like these new women either. They are so old.
Miss Fairfax.
Pray, let me introduce myself to you. My name is Cicely Cardew.
Cicely Cardew. What a very sweet name. Something tells me that we are going to be great friends. I like you already more than I can say. My first impressions of people are never wrong.
How nice of you to like me so much after we have known each other such a comparatively short time. Pray, sit down.
Thank you. I may call you Cicely, may I not?
With pleasure.
And you will always call me Gwendolyn, won't you?
If you wish.
Then that is all quite settled, is it not?
I hope so.
Perhaps this would not be a bad opportunity for my mentioning who I am. My father is Lord Bracknell. You have never heard of Papa, I suppose?
I don't think so.
Outside the family circle, Papa, I am glad to say, is entirely unknown. Mama, whose views on education are remarkably strict, has brought me up to be extremely short-sighted. So do you mind my looking at you through my glasses?
Oh, not at all, Gwendolyn. I am very fond of being looked at.
You are here on a short visit, I suppose?
Oh, no, I live here.
Really? Your mother, no doubt, or some female relative of advanced years, resides here also?
Oh, no, I have no mother, nor in fact any relations.
Indeed.
My dear guardian, with the assistance of Miss Prism, has the arduous task of looking after me.
Your guardian?
Yes, I am Mr. Worthing's ward.
Oh. It is strange he never mentioned to me that he had a ward. How secretive of him. He grows more interesting hourly. I am not sure, however, that the news inspires me with feelings of unmixed delight. I am very fond of you, Cicely. I have liked you ever since I met you. But I am bound to state that now I know that you are Mr. Worthing's ward, I cannot help expressing the wish that you were, well, just a little older than you seem to be, and not quite so very alluring in appearance. In fact, if I may speak candidly...
Pray do. I think that whenever one has anything unpleasant to say, one should always be quite candid.
Well, to speak candidly, Cicely, I wish you were fully 42 and more than unusually plain for your age. Ernest has a strong, upright nature. He is the very soul of truth and honour. But even men of the noblest possible moral character are extremely susceptible to the influence of the physical charms of others. Modern, no less than ancient history, supplies us with many most painful examples of what I refer to. If it were not so, indeed, history would be quite unreadable.
I beg your pardon, Gwendolyn. Did you say Ernest?
Yes.
Oh, but it is not Mr. Ernest Worthing who is my guardian. It is his brother, his elder brother.
Ernest never mentioned to me that he had a brother.
I am sorry to say they have not been on good terms for a long time.
Ah, that accounts for it. And now I think of it, I've never heard any man mention his brother. The subject seems distasteful to most men. Cicely, you have lifted a load from my mind. I was growing almost anxious. It would have been terrible if any cloud had come across a friendship like ours, would it not? Of course, you are quite sure that it is not Mr. Ernest Worthing who is your guardian.
Quite sure. In fact, I am going to be his.
I beg your pardon?
Oh, dearest Gwendolen, there is no reason why I should make any secret of it to you. Our little county newspaper is sure to chronicle the fact next week. Mr. Ernest Worthing and I are engaged to be married.
My darling Cicely, I think there must be some slight error. Mr. Ernest Worthing is engaged to me. The announcement will appear in the Morning Post on Saturday at the latest.
I am afraid you must be under some misconception. Ernest proposed to me exactly 10 minutes ago. I naturally noted the fact in my diary. Pray, see for yourself.
It is certainly very curious, for he asked me to be his wife yesterday afternoon at 5:30. If you would care to verify the incident, pray do so. I never travel without my diary. One should always have something sensational to read in a train. I am so sorry, dear Cicely, if it is any disappointment to you, but I'm afraid I have the prior claim.
It would distress me more than I can tell you, dear Gwendolen, if it caused you any mental or physical anguish, but I feel bound to point out that since Ernest proposed to you, he has clearly changed his mind.
If the poor fellow has been entrapped into any foolish promise, I will consider it my duty to rescue him at once, and with a firm hand.
Whatever unfortunate entanglement my dear boy may have got into, I will never reproach him with it after we are married.
Do you allude to me, Miss Cardew, as an entanglement? You are presumptuous. On an occasion of this kind, it becomes more than a moral duty to speak one's mind. It becomes a pleasure.
Do you suggest, Miss Fairfax, that I entrapped Ernest into an engagement? How dare you! This is no time for wearing the shallow mask of manners. When I see a spade, I call it a spade.
I'm glad to say that I have never seen a spade. It is obvious that our social spheres have been widely different.
Shall I lay tea here as usual, miss?
Yes, Merriman, as usual.
Are there many interesting walks in the vicinity, Miss Cardew?
Oh, yes, a great many. From the top of one of the hills, quite close, one can see 5 counties.
5 counties? I don't think I should like that. I hate crowds.
I suppose that is why you live in town. May I offer you some tea, Miss Fairfax?
Thank you.
Sugar?
No, thank you. Sugar is not fashionable anymore.
Cake or bread and butter?
Bread and butter, please. Cake is rarely seen in the best houses nowadays.
Hand this cup and plate to Miss Fairfax.
Yes, miss.
Thank you. Oh.
That will do, Merriman.
Very well, miss.
You have filled my tea with lumps of sugar, and though I ask most distinctly for bread and butter, you have given me cake. I am known for the gentleness of my disposition and the extraordinary sweetness of my nature, but I warn you, Miss Cardew, you may go too far.
To save my poor, innocent, trusting boy from the machinations of any girl, there are no lengths to which I would not go.
From the moment I saw you, I distrusted you. I felt that you were false and deceitful. I am never deceived in such matters. My first impressions of people are invariably right.
It seems to me, Miss Fairfax, that I am trespassing on your valuable time. No doubt you have many other calls of a similar character to make in the neighbourhood.
Ernest! My own Ernest.
Gwendolen, darling.
A moment. May I ask if you are engaged to be married to this young lady?
To dear little Cicely? Of course not. What could have put such an idea into your pretty little head?
Thank you. You may kiss me.
I knew there must be some misunderstanding, Miss Fairfax. The gentleman whose arm is at present round your waist is my dear guardian, Mr. John Worthing.
I beg your pardon.
This is Uncle Jack.
Jack.
Ah.
Oh.
Here is Ernest.
My own love.
Ernest, may I ask if you are engaged to be married to this young lady?
To what young lady? Good heavens, Gwendolen.
Yes, to good heavens, Gwendolen.
Of course not. What could have put such an idea into your pretty little head?
Thank you. You may kiss me. I felt there was some slight error, Miss Cardew. The gentleman who is now embracing you is my cousin, Mr. Algernon Moncrief. Algernon Moncrief?
Ah.
Oh, are you called Algernon?
I cannot deny it.
Oh, is your name really John?
I could deny it if I liked. I could deny anything if I liked. But my name is John. It has been John for years.
A gross deception has been practiced on both of us.
My poor wounded Cicely.
My sweet, wronged Gwendolyn.
You will call me sister, will you not?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for those words. There is just one question I would like to be allowed to ask my guardian.
An admirable idea. Mr. Worthing, there is just one question I would like to be permitted to put to you. Where is your brother Ernest? We are both engaged to be married to your brother Ernest, so it is a matter of some importance to us to know where your brother Ernest is at present.
Gwendolyn, Cicely, it is very painful for me to be forced to speak the truth. It is the first time in my life that I have ever been reduced to such a painful position, and I am really quite inexperienced in doing anything of the kind, so you must excuse me if I stammer in my tale.
I must beg you to do nothing of the kind, Mr. Worthing. Stammering always gets upon my nerves. Pray, say what you have to say without the smallest hesitation in your speech.
In that case, I will tell you quite frankly that I have no brother Ernest. I have no brother at all. I never had a brother in my life, and I certainly have not the smallest intention of ever having one in the future.
No brother at all?
None.
Had you never a brother of any kind?
Never. Not even of any kind.
And it is quite clear, Cicely, that neither of us is engaged to be married to anyone.
It is not a very pleasant position for a young girl suddenly to find herself in, is it?
Let us go out into the garden. They will hardly venture to come after us there.
No. Men are so cowardly, aren't they?
Yeah.
Pretty mess you've got me into, Algy. What on earth do you mean by coming down here and pretending to be my brother? Perfectly monstrous of you.
What on earth did you mean by pretending to have a brother? Absolutely disgraceful.
I told you to go away by the 3:50. I ordered the dog cart for you. Why on earth didn't you take it?
I hadn't had my tea.
This ghastly state of things is what you call Bunburying, I suppose.
Yes, and a perfectly wonderful Bunbury it is. The most wonderful Bunbury I've ever had in my life.
Well, you've no right whatsoever to Bunbury in my house.
That is absurd. One had a right to Bunbury anywhere one chooses. Every serious Bunburyist knows that.
Serious Bunburyist? Good heavens.
Well, one must be serious about something if one wants to have any amusement in life. I happen to be serious about Bunburying. What on earth you're serious about, I haven't got the remotest idea. About everything, I should fancy. You have such an absolutely trivial nature.
Well, the only small satisfaction I have in the whole of this wretched business is that your friend Bunbury is quite exploded. You won't be able to run down to the country quite so often as you used to do, dear Algy. And a very good thing, too.
Your brother's a little off-colour, isn't he, dear Jack? You won't be able to disappear to London quite as frequently as your wicked custom was. And not a bad thing, either.
As for your conduct towards Miss Cardew, I must say that your taking in a sweet, simple, innocent girl like that is quite inexcusable, to say nothing of the fact that she is my ward.
I can see no possible defence at all for your deceiving a brilliant, clever, thoroughly experienced young lady like Miss Fairfax, to say nothing of the fact that she is my cousin.
I wanted to be engaged to Gwendolyn, that is all. I love her.
Well, I simply wanted to be engaged to Cicely. I adore her.
There is certainly no chance of your marrying Miss Cardew.
I don't think there's much likelihood, Jack, of you and Miss Fairfax being united.
Well, that is no business of yours. And how you can sit there calmly eating muffins when we are in this horrible trouble, I can't make out. You seem to me to be perfectly heartless.
No, I can't eat muffins in an agitated manner. The butter would probably get on my cuffs. One should always eat muffins quite calmly. It's the only way to eat them.
I say it is perfectly heartless you're eating muffins at all, under the circumstances.
When I'm in trouble, eating is the only thing that consoles me. Indeed, when I'm in really great trouble, as anyone who knows me intimately will tell you, I refuse everything except food and drink. At the present moment, I'm eating muffins because I am unhappy. Besides, I'm particularly fond of muffins.
Well, that is no reason why you should eat them all in that greedy way.
I wish you would have tea cake instead. I don't like tea cake.
Good heavens! I suppose a man may eat his own muffins in his own house.
You just said it was perfectly heartless to eat muffins.
I said it was perfectly heartless of you under the circumstances. That is a very different thing.
That may be, but the muffins are the same.
Algy, I wish to goodness you would leave my house. I don't want you here. What on earth are you staying for?
I have not finished my tea yet. And after that, I've got to be baptised.
What on earth do you mean, be baptised?
I've just made arrangements with Dr. Chasuble to be baptised at 6:15 under the name of Ernest.
My dear fellow, the sooner you give up that nonsense, the better. I made arrangements this morning with Dr. Chasuble to be baptised myself at 5:30, and I naturally will take the name of Ernest. Gwendolyn would wish it. We can't both be christened Ernest. It'd be absurd. Besides, I have a perfect right to be baptised if I like. There is no evidence at all that I ever have been baptised by anybody. I should think it extremely probable I never was, and so does Dr. Chasuble. It is entirely different in your case. You have been baptised already.
Yes, but not for years.
Yes, but you have been baptised. That is the important thing.
Quite so. So I know my constitution can stand it. If you're not quite sure about your ever having been baptised, I must say I think it rather dangerous you venturing on it now. Might make you very unwell. You can hardly have forgotten that someone very closely connected with you was very nearly carried off this week in Paris by a severe chill.
Yes, but you said yourself it was not hereditary.
It usedn't to be, I know, but I dare say it is now. Science is always making wonderful improvements in things.
May I ask, Altie, what you propose to do?
Nothing. That is what I've been trying to do for the last 10 minutes, and you have kept doing everything in your power to distract my attention from my work.
Well, I shall go out into the garden and see Gwendolyn. I feel quite sure she expects me.
I know from her extremely cold manner that Cicely expects me, so I certainly shan't go out into the garden. When a man does exactly what a woman expects him to do, she doesn't think much of him. One should always do what a woman doesn't expect, just as one should always say what she doesn't understand. The result is invariably perfect sympathy on both sides.
Oh, that is nonsense. You are always talking nonsense.
No, it's much cleverer to talk nonsense than to listen to it.
I don't listen to you. I can't listen to you.
Oh, that is merely false modesty. You know perfectly well you could listen to me if you tried. You always underrate yourself. An absurd thing to do nowadays when there are such a lot of conceited people about...
Now, Algie, I've already told you to go. I don't want you here. Why don't you go?
I haven't quite finished my tea yet. And there is still one muffin left.
They did not follow us at once into the garden as anyone else would have done, seems to me to show that they have some sense of shame left.
They have been eating muffins. That looks like repentance.
They don't seem to notice us at all. Couldn't you cough?
But I haven't got a cough.
They're looking at us. What effrontery. Let us enter and preserve a dignified silence.
Certainly. It is the only thing to do now.
This dignified silence does not seem to produce the desired effect.
Quite the reverse.
But we will not be the first to speak.
Certainly not.
Mr. Worthing, I have something very particular to ask you. Much depends on your reply.
Gwendolyn, your common sense is invaluable. Mr. Moncrief, kindly answer me the following question. Why did you pretend to be my guardian's brother?
In order that I might have an opportunity of meeting you.
That certainly seems a satisfactory explanation, does it not?
Yes, if you can believe him.
I don't. But that does not affect the wonderful beauty of his answer.
True. In matters of grave importance, style, not sincerity, is the vital thing. Mr. Worthing... What explanation can you offer to me for pretending to have a brother? Was it in order that you might have an opportunity of coming up to town to see me as often as possible?
Can you doubt it, Miss Fairfax?
I have the gravest doubts upon the subject, but I intend to crush them. The explanations appear to be quite satisfactory, especially Mr. Worthing's. That seems to me to have the stamp of truth on it.
I am more than content with what Mr. Moncrief said. His voice alone inspires one with absolute credulity.
Then you think we should forgive them?
Yes. I mean, no.
True. I had forgotten. There are principles at stake that one cannot surrender. Which of us should tell them? The task is not a pleasant one.
Could we not both speak at the same time?
An excellent idea. I often speak at the same time as other people. Will you take the time from me?
Mm-hmm.
One, two.
Your Christian names are still an absolutely insuperable barrier. That is all.
Our Christian names? Is that all? But we are going to be christened this afternoon.
For my sake, you are prepared to do this terrible thing, Mr. Worthing.
Certainly.
To please me, you are ready to face this fearful ordeal, Mr. Moncrief.
I am.
How absurd to talk of the equality of the sexes. Where questions of self-sacrifice are concerned, men are infinitely beyond us.
They have moments of physical courage of which we women know absolutely nothing.
Darling Gwendolyn.
Darling Cecily. Oh.
Lady Bracknell.
Oh, good heavens.
Gwendolyn, what does this mean?
Merely that I am engaged to be married to Mr. Worthing, Mama.
Come over here at once.
Certainly, Mama. But I am engaged to be married to Mr. Worthing.
Silence, child. Come here. At once. Hesitation of any kind is a sign of mental decay in the young, of physical weakness in the old. Mr. Worthing.
Lady Bracknell.
Apprised of my daughter's sudden flight by her trusty maid, whose confidence I purchased by means of a small coin, I followed her at once by a luggage train. Her unhappy father is, I am glad to say, under the impression that she is attending a more than usually lengthy lecture at the University Extension Scheme on the influence of a permanent income on thought. I do not propose to undeceive him. Indeed, I have never undeceived him on any question. I would consider it wrong. But, of course, you will clearly understand that all communication between yourself and my daughter must cease immediately from this moment. On this point, as indeed on all points, I am firm.
I am engaged to be married to Gwendolyn, Lady Bracknell.
You are nothing of the kind, sir. And now, as regards Algernon. Algernon?
Yes, Aunt Augusta.
May I ask if it is in this house that your invalid friend, Mr. Bunbury, resides?
Oh, no, Bunbury doesn't live here. Bunbury is somewhere else at present. In fact, Bunbury is dead.
Dead? But when did Mr. Bunbury die? His death must have been extremely sudden.
I killed Bunbury this afternoon. I mean, poor Bunbury died this afternoon.
What did he die of?
Bunbury? Oh, he was quite exploded.
Exploded?
Hmm.
Was he the victim of a revolutionary outrage?
No, my dear Aunt Augusta, I mean, he was found out. The doctors found out that Bunbury could not live, so Bunbury died.
He seems to have had great confidence in the opinion of his physicians.
Hmm.
I'm glad, however, that he made up his mind at the last to some definite course of action. And now that we have finally got rid of this Mr. Bunbury, may I ask, Mr. Worthing, who is that young lady whose hand my nephew Algernon is now holding in what seems to me a peculiarly unnecessary manner?
That, Lady Bracknell, is Miss Cicely Cardew, my ward.
I'm engaged to be married to Cicely, Aunt Augusta.
I do not know whether there is anything peculiarly exciting in the air of this part of Hertfordshire, but the number of engagements that go on seem to me considerably above the proper average that statistics have laid down for our guidance. I think some preliminary inquiry on my part would not be out of place. Mr. Worthing, is Miss Cardew at all connected with any of the large railway stations in London? I ask merely for information. Until yesterday, I had no idea that there were any families or persons whose origin was a terminus.
Miss Cardew is the granddaughter of the late Mr. Thomas Cardew, of 149 Belgrave Square, SW, Gervais Park, Dorking, Surrey, and the Sporran, Fifeshire.
That sounds not unsatisfactory. Three addresses always inspire confidence. But what proof have I of their authenticity?
I have carefully preserved the court guides of the period. They are open to your inspection, Lady Bracknell.
I've known strange errors in that publication.
Miss Cardew's family solicitors are Messrs. Markby, Markby and Markby of 149A Lincoln's Inn Fields, London. I have no doubt they will be happy to supply you with any further information.
Markby, Markby and Markby. A firm of the very highest position in their profession. Indeed, I am told that one of the Markbys is occasionally to be seen at dinner parties. So far, I am satisfied.
How extremely kind of you, Lady Bracknell. I have also in my possession, you will be pleased to hear, certificates of Miss Cardew's birth, registration, baptism, whooping cough, vaccination, confirmation, and the measles, both the German and the English variety.
Ah, a life crowded with incident, I see, though perhaps somewhat too exciting for a young girl. I am not myself in favour of premature experiences. Gwendolyn?
Yes, Mama.
The time approaches for our departure. As a matter of form, Mr. Worthing, I'd better ask you if Miss Cardew has any little fortune.
Oh, about £130,000 in the funds. That is all. Goodbye, Lady Bracknell. So pleased to have seen you.
A moment, Mr. Worthing. £130,000? And in the funds. Miss Cardew seems to me a most attractive young lady now that I look at her. Few girls of the present day have any really solid qualities, any of the qualities that last and improve with time. We live, I regret to say, in an age of surfaces. Come over here, dear child.
Yes, Lady Bracknell?
Your dress is sadly simple, and your hair seems almost as nature might have left it. But we can soon alter that. A thoroughly experienced French maid produces a really marvellous result in a very brief space of time. I remember recommending one to young Lady Lansing, and after 3 months her own husband did not know her.
And after 6 months nobody knew her.
Kindly turn round, sweet child. Yes, quite as I expected. There are distinct social possibilities in your profile.
Really, Lady Bracknell? How very gratifying.
The two weak points in our age are its want of principle and its want of profile. The chin a little higher, dear. Style largely depends on the way the chin is worn. They're worn very high just at present. Algernon?
Yes, Aunt Augusta.
There are distinct social possibilities in Miss Cardew's profile.
Cicely is the sweetest, dearest, prettiest girl in the whole world, and I don't care tuppence about social possibilities.
Never speak disrespectfully of society, Algernon. Only people who can't get into it do that. Dear child, of course you know that Algernon has nothing but his debts to depend on. But I do not approve of mercenary marriages. When I married Lord Bracknell, I had no fortune of any kind. But I never dreamed for a moment of letting that stand in my way. Well, I suppose I must give my consent.
Oh. Thank you, Aunt Augusta.
Cicely, you may kiss me.
Thank you, Lady Bracknell.
You may also address me as Aunt Augusta for the future.
Thank you, Aunt Augusta.
The marriage, I think, had better take place quite soon.
Oh, thank you, Aunt Augusta.
To speak frankly, I'm not in favour of long engagements. They give people the opportunity of finding out their true characters before marriage, which I think is never advisable.
I beg your pardon for interrupting you, Lady Bracknell, but this engagement is quite out of the question.
Mr. Worthing?
I am Miss Cardew's guardian. She cannot marry without my consent until she comes of age. That consent I absolutely decline to give.
Upon what grounds, may I ask? Algernon is an extremely, I may say, almost ostentatiously eligible young man. To my own knowledge, he is on the list of nearly all the mothers in London.
It pains me very much to have to speak frankly to you, Lady Bracknell, about your nephew, but the fact is that I do not approve at all of his moral character. I suspect him of being untruthful.
Untruthful? My nephew, Algernon? Impossible. He is an Oxonian.
I fear there can be no possible doubt about the matter. This morning, at 12:30, during my temporary absence in London on important business, he obtained admission into my house by means of the false pretense of being my brother. Under an assumed name, he drank an entire pint bottle of my 74 champagne, a wine I was specially reserving for myself. Continuing his disgraceful deception, he succeeded in the course of the afternoon in alienating the affections of my only ward. He subsequently stayed to tea and devoured every single muffin.
What?
And what makes his conduct all the more heartless is that he was perfectly well aware from the first that I have no brother, and I never had a brother of any kind. I distinctly told him so myself yesterday afternoon.
But, dear Uncle Jack, for the last year you have been telling us all that you had a brother. You dwelt continually on the subject.
Pardon me, Cicely, you are a little too young to understand these matters. To invent anything is an act of genius, but to corroborate a falsehood is the action of a coward.
Upon my word, Jack!
Mr. Worthing, after careful consideration, I have decided to overlook entirely my nephew's conduct to you, painful though it had been. Oh,
that is very generous of you, Lady Bracknell. My own decision, however, is unalterable. I decline to give my consent.
How old are you, sweet child?
Well, I am really only 18, but I always admit to 20 when I go to evening parties.
You are perfectly right in making some slight alteration. Indeed, under no circumstances should a woman ever be quite accurate about her age. It looks so calculating. 18, but admitting to 20 at evening parties. Well, whichever date you choose, it will not be very long before you are of age and free from the restraints of tutelage. So I don't think that your guardian's consent to this alliance is, after all, a matter of much, if any, importance.
Pray excuse me, Lady Bracknell, for interrupting you again, but it is only fair to tell you that according to the terms of her grandfather's will, Miss Cardew does not come legally of age till she is 35.
What? That does not seem to me a grave objection. 35 is a very attractive age. London society is full of women of the very highest birth who have, of their own free choice, remained 35 for years. Lady Dumbleton is an instance in point. To my own knowledge, she has been 35 ever since she arrived at the age of 40, which was many years ago now. I see no reason why our dear Cicely should not be even still more attractive at the age you mention than she is now. There will be a large accumulation of property.
You are quite sure, Uncle Jack, that I can't marry without your consent till I am 35.
That is the wise provision of your grandfather's will, Cicely.
Algy, could you wait for me till I was 35? Don't speak hastily. It is a very serious question, and much of my future happiness, as well as all of yours, depends upon your answer.
Of course I could, Cicely. How can you ask me such a question? I could wait forever for you. You know I could.
Yes. I felt it instinctively. I am sorry for you, Algy, because I couldn't wait all that time. I hate waiting even 5 minutes for anybody. I'm not punctual myself, but I do like punctuality in others, and waiting, even to be married, is quite out of the question.
Then what is to be done, Cicely?
I don't know.
My dear Mr. Worthing, as Miss Cardew states positively that she cannot wait till she is 35... a remark which I'm bound to say seems to me to show a somewhat impatient nature. I would beg of you to reconsider your decision.
But, my dear Lady Bracknell, the matter is entirely in your own hands. The moment you consent to my marriage with Gwendolen, I will most gladly allow your nephew to form an alliance with my ward.
Mr. Worthing, you must be quite aware that what you propose is out of the question.
Then a passionate and careful celibacy is all that any of us can look forward to.
That is not the destiny I propose for Gwendolen. Algernon, of course, can choose for himself. Come, Gwendolen, we've already missed 5, if not 6 trains. To miss any more might expose us to comment on the platform.
Everything is quite ready for the christening. I have been waiting in the church porch for nearly 30 minutes.
The christening, sir? Is not that somewhat premature?
Both these gentlemen have expressed a desire for immediate baptism.
At their age, the idea is grotesque and irreligious. Algernon, I forbid you to be baptized. I will not hear of such excesses. Lord Bracknell will be highly displeased if he learned that was the way in which you wasted your time and money.
Am I to understand, then, that there are to be no baptisms at all this afternoon?
I don't think that as things now stand, it will be of any practical value to either of us, Dr. Chasuble.
Oh, I am grieved to hear such sentiments from you, Mr. Worthing. They savour of the heretical views of the Anabaptist, views that I have completely refuted in 4 of my unpublished sermons. I shall return to the church at once. Indeed, I have just been informed by the pew opener that for the last 1.5 hours Miss Prism has been waiting for me in the vestry.
Miss Prism? Did I hear you mention a Miss Prism?
Yes, indeed. I am on my way to join her.
Pray allow me to detain you for a moment. This matter may prove to be one of vital importance to Lord Bracknell and myself. Is this Miss Prism a female of repellent aspect, remotely connected with education?
She is the most cultivated of ladies and the very picture of respectability.
She's obviously the same person. May I ask what position she holds in your household?
I am a celibate, madam.
Miss Prism, Lady Bracknell, has been for the last 3 years Miss Cardew's esteemed governess and valued companion.
Then let me strongly advise you, Mr. Worthing, should she ever turn out to be the person I suspect her of being, never allow her, under any circumstances, to take Miss Cardew out in a perambulator.
What?
The result might be lamentable. I must see this Miss Prism at once. Let her be sent for.
She approaches. She is nigh.
I was told you expected me in the vestry, dear Canon. I have been waiting for you there for 1.75 hours.
Prism!
Oh,
Come here, Prism.
Lady Bracknell.
Prism, where is that baby? 28 years ago, Prism, you left Lord Bracknell's house, number 104 Upper Grosvenor Street, in charge of a perambulator that contained a baby of the male sex. You never returned. A few weeks later, through the elaborate investigation of the Metropolitan Police, the perambulator was discovered at midnight, standing by itself, in a remote corner of Bayswater. It contained the manuscript of a 3-volume novel of more than usually revolting sentimentality. But the baby was not there. Prism, where is that baby?
Lady Bracknell, I admit with shame that I do not know. I only wish I did. The plain facts of the case are these. On the morning of the day you mention, a day that is forever branded in my memory, I prepared as usual to take the baby out in its perambulator. I had also with me a somewhat old but capacious handbag in which I intended to place the manuscript of a 3-volume novel that I had written during my few unoccupied hours. In a moment of mental abstraction, for which I can never forgive myself, I deposited the manuscript in the bassinet and placed the baby in the handbag.
But where did you deposit the handbag?
Do not ask me, Mr. Worthing.
Miss Prism, this is a matter of no small importance to me. I insist on knowing where you deposited the handbag that contained the infant.
I left it, Mr. Worthing, in the cloakroom of one of the large railway stations in London.
What railway station?
Victoria. The Brighton line.
I sincerely hope nothing improbable is going to happen.
I must retire to my bedroom for a moment.
This news seems to have upset you, Mr. Worthing. I trust your indisposition is merely temporary.
I will be back in a few moments, dear Canon. Dear Gwendolyn, wait here for me.
If you are not too long, I will wait here for you all my life.
What do you think this means, Lady Bracknell?
I dare not even suspect, Dr. Chasuble. I need hardly tell you that in families of high position, strange coincidences are not supposed to occur.
Uncle Jack seems strangely agitated.
Your guardian has a very emotional nature.
This noise is extremely unpleasant. Sounds as if he was having an argument with the furniture. I dislike arguments of any kind. They are always vulgar and usually violent.
It has stopped now.
No, it has begun again.
I wish you would arrive at some conclusion.
This suspense is terrible. I hope it will last.
Is this the handbag, Miss Prism? Now, examine it carefully before you speak. The happiness of more than one life depends on your answer.
It seems to be mine. Yes! Here is the injury it received through the upsetting of a Gower Street omnibus in younger and happier days. Here is the indelible stain left on the lining by the accidental explosion of a temperance beverage, an incident that occurred at Leamington. Yes, and here, on the lock, are my initials. I had forgotten that, in an extravagant mood, I had them placed there. Yes, the bag is undoubtedly mine. I am delighted to have it so unexpectedly restored to me. It has been a great inconvenience being without it all these years.
But, Miss Prism, more is restored to you than this handbag. I was the baby you placed in it.
You?
Yes. Mother!
Mr. Worthing! I am unmarried!
Unmarried? I do not deny that is a serious blow, but after all, who has the right to throw a stone against one who has suffered? Cannot repentance wipe out an act of folly? Why should there be one law for men, another for women? Mother! I forgive you!
Mr. Worthing! There is some error. Maternity has never been an incident in my life.
There stands the lady who can tell you who you really are.
What? Lady Bracknell. I hate to seem inquisitive, Lady Bracknell, but would you kindly inform me who I am?
I'm afraid that the news I have to give you will not altogether please you. You are the son of my poor sister, Mrs. Moncrief, and consequently Algernon's elder brother.
Algy's elder brother? I say. Then I have a brother after all. I knew I had a brother. I always said I had a brother. Oh, Cicely, how could you ever have doubted that I had a brother? Dr. Chasuble, my unfortunate brother. Miss Prism, my unfortunate brother. Gwendolyn, my unfortunate brother. Oh, Algy, you young scoundrel. You will have to treat me with more respect in the future. Yeah. You've never behaved to me like a brother in all your life.
Well, not till today, old boy, I admit. I did my best, however. I was out of practice.
Under these strange and unforeseen circumstances, you can kiss your Aunt Augusta.
I am dazed with happiness.
Mr. Worthing, Mr. Moncrief, as I should call you now, after what has just occurred, I feel it my duty to resign my position in this household. Any inconvenience I may have caused you in your infancy through placing you inadvertently in this handbag, I sincerely apologize for.
Don't mention it, dear Miss Prism. Don't mention anything. I am sure I had a very pleasant time in your nice handbag. As for leaving us, the suggestion is absurd.
It is my duty to leave. I have really nothing more to teach, dear Cicely. In the very difficult accomplishment of getting married, I fear my sweet and clever pupil has far outstripped her teacher.
Oh, a moment. Laetitia.
Dr. Chasuble.
Laetitia, I have come to the conclusion that the primitive church was in error on certain points. Corrupt readings seem to have crept into the text. I beg to solicit the honor of your hand.
Frederick, at the present moment, words fail me to express my feelings. But I will forward you this evening the three last volumes of my diary.
Oh.
In these, you will be able to peruse a full account of the sentiments that I have entertained towards you for the past 18 months.
Prism, from your last observation to Dr. Chasuble, I learn with regret that you have not yet given up your ridiculously sentimental passion for fiction in three volumes. And if you really are going to enter into the state of matrimony, which at your age seems to me, I feel bound to say, rather like flying in the face of an all-wise providence, I trust you will be more careful of your husband than you were of your infant charge.
Yes.
Cicely, sweet child, we will expect you at Upper Grosvenor Street in a few days.
Thank you, Aunt Augusta.
Come, Gwendolyn.
My dearest.
My own. But what own are you? What is your Christian name now that you have become someone else?
Good heavens! I'd quite forgotten that point. Your decision on the subject of my name is irrevocable, I suppose.
I never change, except in my affections. What a noble nature you have, Gwendolyn.
Then the question had better be cleared up at once. Aunt Augusta, a moment.
Yes?
At the time when Miss Prism left me in the handbag, had I been christened already? Pray be calm, Aunt Augusta. Much depends on your answer.
Every luxury that money could buy, including christening, had been lavished on you by your fond and doting parents.
Then I was christened? That is settled. Now, what name was I given? Let me know the worst.
Being the eldest son, you were naturally christened after your father. I distinctly remember you being christened after your father.
Yes, but what was my father's Christian name? Pray, don't be too calm, Aunt Augusta. What was my father's Christian name?
I cannot at the present moment recall what the general's Christian name was. Your poor dear mother always addressed him as the general. No. That I remember perfectly. Indeed, I don't think she would have dared to have called him by his Christian name, but I've no doubt he had one. He was violent in his manner, but there was nothing eccentric about him in any way. That was the result of the Indian climate and marriage and indigestion.
Algy! Can't you recollect what our father's Christian name was?
Oh, my dear boy, we never were on those sort of terms. Indeed, I don't think we can ever have been on speaking terms. He died before I was a year old.
His name would appear in the army lists of the period, I suppose, Aunt Augusta.
The general was essentially a man of peace, except in his domestic life. But I have no doubt his name would appear in any military directory.
The army lists of the last 40 years are here. Oh, these delightful records should have been my constant study. Generals. Mallon, Markby, Migsby, Mobbs, Moncrief! Lieutenant, 1840, Captain, Lieutenant Colonel, General, 1860, Christian names. Ernest John. Well, I always told you, Gwendolyn, my name was Ernest, didn't I? Well, it is Ernest, after all. I mean, it naturally is Ernest.
Yes, I remember now that the general was called Ernest. I knew I had some particular reason for disliking the name.
Ernest. My own Ernest. I felt from the first that you could have no other name.
Gwendolyn, it is a terrible thing for a man to find out suddenly that all his life he has been speaking nothing but the truth. Can you forgive me?
I can. For I feel sure you are sure to change.
My own one.
Letitia.
Frederick! At last!
Cicely, at last!
Oh. Gwendolyn, at last! Oh.
My nephew, you seem to be displaying signs of triviality.
On the contrary, Aunt Augusta, I've now realized for the first time in my life the vital importance of being earnest.
In The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde, Judy Dench played Lady Bracknell, Martin Clunes, Algernon Moncrief, Michael Sheen, John Worthing, Samantha Bond, Gwendolyn, Amanda Root, Cicely, Miriam Margolyes, Miss Prism, Don Moffat, Canon Chasuble, Michael Horden, Lane, and Terence Alexander, Merriman. The piano was played by Terence Albright. Technical presentation was by Wilfredo Acosta, assisted by Roz Mason and Alison McKenzie. This production, which was taken from the 3- and 4-act versions of the play, was directed by Glyn Dearman.